And that's a problem. I need my hands.
Welcome to Clock or Counter. I'm Ryan Young, and with me is James Wiseman. So today, James, I have a couple questions for you. But before we get to them, why don't you give us a few updates from the last month?
Okay, you and I have not spoken in probably 6 weeks. It's very unusual. I feel like we have lots to catch up on. And for better or worse, we're doing it on this podcast. So the big freestyle update is that the jam was a week or two ago, and it was super fun, especially because I had a big Airbnb with Jake, Lori, and three of my Duke freestylers, Brendan, Ray, and Will, who all got to Florida on their own, including Ray and Will taking a night train to get there, which is the kind of commitment I've been waiting to see from them. And then I think all of them found their way back home, except for one or two of them. So they actually kind of did it all on their own, which is the next level of freestyle dedication. What do you think of that?
Yeah, they're adults now. They're living by themselves. Okay, here's the one story. So Will and Ray are living in my house in North Carolina at the moment. And maybe like a week after they moved in, they texted me a picture of a bowl that had a little bit of like leftover food in it. It had like spots of mold growing in it. And the text was, "Hey, do you want us to replace this bowl? It grew a little bit of mold." And I was like, "Wait, can you try wiping it out with a sponge first?" And I was like, "Oh, this is the first time they've been living by themselves."
There's been a few moments where I'm watching two young men become adults where they will call me and ask me a question. I'm just like, "I don't know, figure it out." Like that's a grown-up problem. You just solve it. What do I know about the hex wrench required to open up that lawnmower? Just like look it up. But for me, I was fired up because I know at an earlier stage in my freestyle career, Dan and I were already obsessed and doing absurd things to find ways to make it to tournaments. And I've always been a little bit disappointed that the Duke guys didn't get there yet. But I think I was in a car ride with Will where he was sort of like, "Well, I have work till Friday. Maybe I could go just on Saturday." I mean, it's like working out some pretty extreme logistics just to be able to jam one day. But ultimately, he got there for 2 days and he had an absolute blast. And the event was great. The win was really good, especially the last day. I felt like the win was just perfect. It still feels a little bit like we're at the end of something, not at the beginning of something, in terms of, like, we had a good turnout, but all the players are definitely getting a little bit older. And it's kind of like how in Virginia we used to jam till 1 a.m. and now the jam's over at 6:00. There's a little bit of, wow, the beach is available and no one's there yet. And there's still like 2 hours of hard pack left, but everyone is packing it up. But otherwise, it was a blast. Playing with Jake is always super enlightening. I think he just keeps getting better and better. And so that was really awesome. But probably the thing that was most heartwarming for me is to see Dave Murphy play after his knee surgery. He's still playing really, really well at a super high level. He definitely played a lot less than I've seen him play in the past, but I'm just happy that he's out there and still shredding. So hopefully he's got another couple decades left in him, because he's certainly one of my favorite jam partners. So that's really all I have to say about the jam. Thanks to Paul Kenny for running that event every year. It's always such a pleasure, and we'll keep going every year. And hopefully we'll have more and more Duke students coming to replace the fewer and fewer American vanguard of freestyle. Otherwise, I don't really have any Duke updates, except it's kind of a crazy summer because I have three Duke students here, although Brendan just left to go work in Baltimore. But yeah, Ray and Will are just down the street now. And honestly, it's exhausting because every day there's some kind of Frisbee requirement. And so I'm getting pretty worn out, but Will goes easy on me. And the nice thing is Will will just play by himself if I'm not up for the challenge. But like today, Will works in Durham. So he goes to Ultimate 45 minutes early, practices freestyle by himself. Then we played Ultimate for 2 hours, and then we jammed another like 20 minutes at the end of Ultimate. And then I'm sure he just went home and played more. So if he's not the best player in the world within a year, I don't know what everyone else is doing wrong, right? I don't know. I kind of got lost in my little head there. Okay, but that's what's going on freestyle-wise. But I had one other quick update, which is there is this very casual event in Durham hosted by one of my Frisbee friends called a Chautauqua, which is a tradition. I should have looked this up, but I think it's from like the 18th century among like rural communities where groups would get together and people would present on topics. And the way my friend Sam always explains it is that everyone was really bored back then. And so this was like a fun thing to do. And it kind of died out when the radio was invented, which is not surprising, but it still exists in certain places. For instance, someone pointed out that Salman Rushdie, who had the knife attack a couple, maybe a year or two ago, it was at a Chautauqua. So it is still existing and in bigger forms elsewhere. But anyway, so they do it at Durham, and Sam asked me to do a presentation. And, you know, I was thinking, what on earth could I present about? Freestyle is sort of the obvious thing because it's the most idiosyncratic thing that I do. But I don't know. I didn't really want to talk about freestyle too much, and I couldn't really figure out a way to make it interesting. But of course, the only other thing I know about in the world is law. And so I figured I would do a presentation on rulemaking, and I would use our experience working on the new judging system as kind of a like interesting topic to talk about rulemaking. And of course, I was pretty nervous because, as I can imagine, people listening to this right now might think, how interesting could making rules possibly be? And of course, I think it's very interesting. That's why I'm one of the few people who really liked law school. But it turns out everyone did think it was really interesting. So for instance, one of the things that I was really nervous about is I had a section that was trying to illustrate how difficult it is to make specific rules, even for something that seems very simple. So I took the 2-point shot in the NBA as an example, and I actually pulled the language of the NBA rules into this PowerPoint. And I was going to do like what you would do in law school, where you read through the rule and break it down. And I thought it would be very easy to lose everyone in this and for people to glaze over. But instead, people were howling with laughter because they saw how ludicrous this rule was and how if you tried to analyze it, it actually completely fell apart under scrutiny. So everyone really got it. And that was very exciting to me. But I'll go through like the 3 or 4 main topics that I had. And then I want to talk about some of the incredible questions and commentary I got from the crowd. So my main premise was that like the kind of setup was, imagine you're a freestyler in the 70s and you're tasked with turning this loosey-goosey form of play into a competitive sport. And how do you do that? And so my first premise is that every sport is really just a bunch of rules. So you have to come up with the rules in order to design the competitive system. And if you want to design the rules, you really have to figure out what your values are, because how are you going to know? Should it be a team sport? Should it be an objective-based sport like basketball, where you have to perform certain actions to score? Or is it a subjective-based sport like we have in freestyle, where you just perform freestyle and you're judged in certain categories? So we kind of like went through that. And I think for a lot of people, it's sort of weird to think about sports as just a series of rules, but that's kind of what they are ultimately. But then we talked about, okay, once you have the basic framework of how the competition is going to be, you have to decide what categories you're going to judge the players on. And we talked about how ultimately competition, putting aside like secondary values, like we talk about how competition is good for spreading the jam or bringing the community together. But like competition in its textbook definition is about figuring out who the best players are. So if you want to figure out how to make your competitive rules, you have to decide, well, what are the things that make players the best? And then you design your rules and categories to reward the players that exemplify those attributes. And so the first thing that was fun is I asked the audience, having seen one jam video, what would you pick as the categories? And I think, if not the first thing, one of the first things someone said, which was so bewildering to me, someone said, keep it moving. And I was like, The crazy thing is, I said that on a podcast and someone like made shirts out of it. Like, yeah. I was like, that is like such a specific thing to say. I have no idea what that would mean in the context of a competitive judging category, but I thought that was super weird and interesting that someone said that and that it was something that I had said recently.
No, I get it.
I mean, I think it would be kind of a cool category. I mean, we talk all the time, and I think I talked to her or somebody else afterwards about this, about how when we, I think we did a podcast on it when we were giving routine advice, one of the things we said is like move around a lot and like use the entire field and use of space. So it was kind of a interesting thought. And I think for some of these categories, maybe even keep it moving, I talked about how it was sort of implicit or a part of some other category. So artistry, of course, could include use of space and movement. My favorite one that someone said was swag. And I thought that was a pretty sick category. And I told them that there used to be a tournament, one of Skippy's tournaments, where vibes was a category. And I wish I could remember what some of the other people said. I know when I did a practice with the organizer, he said novelty. And I told him, well, that was certainly something that's been proposed at different times. But obviously, it's not at least a standalone category in freestyle. We also talked about something that I think we lose sight of when we talk about freestyle, which is it's not super obvious that any of the categories we have are right or wrong. So I talked about how like I'm not sure I actually talked about all the things I'm saying I talked about, but these are things I at least planned on talking about. And who knows? It's like a routine, right? Who knows what I actually did when it came time to do it. But it's sort of like most sports don't reward artistry. Like they just all that matters is that you score the points. You could build freestyle like that. You could just say, if you do a bunch of hard moves, then you get good scores and we don't really care how it looks. That's not how I would do it. And it's not how we did it. But it's like, you know, it's just kind of we decided that beauty is really important. We also obviously decided that execution is important, but we'll come back to some of the stuff we talked about in terms of execution of this presentation. But I also pointed out how variety is kind of a weird category. It's certainly a category that I have promoted a lot, even though I'm starting to have second thoughts about it, because it really isn't obvious that having variety necessarily makes you a better player. In other words, like you could be the best player in the world without a lot of variety. And my analogy was something like, you know, the best dish you could make is not necessarily the one with the most ingredients, or like we don't really ding the Beatles because they mostly played pop music. It's sort of like you could be the best musician in the world and just be Taylor Swift and play like Taylor Swift songs. But whatever, I was mostly just trying to point out that our rules reflect our values and everyone's values differ, so we don't necessarily like agree on them. But then we talked about rules and standards, which we've talked a lot about on this podcast. So we did like a whole exercise where I tried to get the audience to come up with definitions of a drop. And then I would show with the Frisbee okay. why their definitions like didn't work. And the crazy thing is I had planned out like three or four definitions that I knew were logical definitions that people might propose, but that didn't work. And when I asked, like, what's the definition of a drop? The first person who raised her hand was like, the disc hits the ground. And I was like, next slide. And the next slide said, like, disc hits the ground. And then I showed, like, well, what if I caught it like this? And I caught a flawed where the disc hits the ground. And the other thing I was nervous about is like, well, people pick up on what's happening and everyone starts laughing and they're like, oh, like, you caught it, but the disc hit the ground. And I was like, exactly. And I was like, well, how could we change the definition to fix this? And someone raised their hand and was like, the disc hits the ground, but it's not in your hands. And I was like, next slide. And that's like exactly what my next slide said. It's like that could not have worked more perfectly, which was super exciting. And then we kind of landed on what I personally view. And like, I know I've said this in judging committee meetings as like the actual rule, which is, you know, a drop when you see it. And that's a 0.3. And if it's worse than that, give it a 0.4 or 0.5. If it's better, give it a 0.2 or 0.1. But people like seem to follow the logic of the freestyle and get into it. And I mostly just sort of talked about for a sport like freestyle, where it's so unbounded and reality is so infinitely complex, it's really hard to make specific bright line rules that are objective. And we often have to resort to standards where it's like very loosey-goosey. Like I talked about how you have 3 minutes to play, and so you need some rule to know when to start the routine. And the most obvious rule would be you start the routine on the first throw. But of course, people have found so many ways to start routines that don't involve a throw that really doesn't really work. And I've said this at competitions. It's kind of unfair, right? Because I sort of like talked about freestyle rules as if they were written down in a book somewhere, but honestly, they're really not. And like some of these are just like, well, these are things I've told people at Worlds in my judging presentation. But it's like, I view the rule for the first throw as, if you're going to do something really weird, tell the judges, otherwise you operate at your own peril. Like if you are going to start in a weird way where it's unclear when your routine begins, you might get screwed if the judges pick the wrong point in your routine. But anyway, so like I kept it pretty simple. Like those are kind of the only freestyle concepts I talked about. I didn't go into like difficulty and nonlinear judging or like some of the crazier stuff that I think would have been very interesting, but it obviously would have been like a 20-hour presentation, as anyone who's listened to our many long judging podcasts would know. But at the end, and then my last topic, just to kind of wrap up what I actually talked about, I talked about how rules change behavior. And I was just sort of like, you can make a rule that seems well tailored to what's happened in the past, but it's hard to account for how that rule will change people's behavior. And I talked about, and here's where I'm like kind of loosey goosey with history because I don't really know how it all played out, but I was sort of like, well, you can imagine in the 70s when you're building the freestyle system, you're like, hey, like one of the things that the best freestylers do is they execute well. So let's make execution a really important category. Aside for reasons that we'll get into, I think it was kind of accidental how important execution turned out to be. But like obviously execution was the most important category for a long time, at least when we started playing. And I talk about how, well, execution in theory is a very good measure for who the best players are. But, and here's where I went to Goodhart's law, which is that when the measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. So once everybody knows that execution is the way to score the most points in freestyle, they can freestyle in a way that emphasizes execution, but doesn't necessarily emphasize better freestyle. And I just pointed out, and I just threw the disc and delayed it for 20 seconds. I was like, I can do this for 3 minutes and have a perfect execution score, but I haven't actually demonstrated a superior level of freestyle as anybody else. So even though it made a lot of sense to reward execution, when the reward for it became too extreme, it ceased to measure something actually important. But then to make fun of myself, I said, so we slashed execution and made it virtually meaningless and everything was great, right? And of course, everyone's like laughing and understood right away. I was like, well, how many drops do you think happen now compared to in the past? And like, is it better that world's routines now have 10 drops instead of 3? And your mileage may vary. But anyways, the part that I really wanted to talk about is at the end of the presentation, when I asked for questions, I got a lot of interesting questions for people. But my favorite is this guy raises his hand and he was a statistician. And he said, and at this point, I'd really only explained execution. He said, you told us that when a player drops the disc, they get an execution deduction. And I'm wondering how the other categories are calculated to, I don't know exactly how he said it, to like figure out the relative weight of each category. However he asked it, like I understood right away that he was asking about the balancing. And I think he said, I think I said, okay, well, let me explain very quickly. And I was like, execution, you start with 10 and you have deductions downwards and they're just linear deductions. AI, you have a bunch of subcategories at the end of the round, you go 0 to 10 and those subcategories are averaged. So you have a final score between 0 and 10. I was talking about the old system, by the way, at this point. And then for difficulty, you have time blocks, you put in a score between 0 and 10 after every 15 seconds, and then you average all the scores together. And maybe it was here where he asked the question. He was like, well, if you average difficulty time blocks, like all those scores are going to be between like 4 and 6, whereas your execution scores, if you're doing deductions, can be between 0 and 10. And I was like, sir, you are preaching to the choir. This has been a passion of mine. And I told him, you know, if I had another principle for this presentation, it would have been that rule makers are terrible at math. And I talked about how it made a lot of facial sense back in the day to say, we'll have 3 categories. They're all between 0 and 10. They're equally weighted. But of course, that's not how it works in reality, as anyone who's listened to me blither about it will understand. The only thing that matters is the spread. And I told him how, you know, yeah, the execution spread was between 2 and 10, and the difficulty spread was between 4 and 5.5 or whatever it was. And so in reality, execution counted way more than whatever. And he was like, yeah, that sounds like a problem. And I talked about how we've tried to fix it, but it is really a back and forth between making the changes and seeing how it plays out. And as I've told everyone who asked me, you can't know a priori before the fact how each category is weighted. It's more like you can set up a system so that in general, in the average routine, they'll be weighted a certain way mathematically. But there may be some routines, some rounds where the category weights are totally out of whack just by the nature of how the teams perform and how the judges score it. But whatever, I've talked about this a million times, but I felt so vindicated because there are lots of times, you know, it's like interesting because I came at it from a perspective of like, the one thing that was nice for me when we did all that process is I'm a lawyer. And so I have a lot of like, at least school learning. And it's not like my job to make rules. I'm not a legislator, but like I have a lot of school learning about like rules and making rules and what the pitfalls of doing that. But the one thing I didn't know a lot about that I think we were all kind of learning on the fly was the math side of things. And there are times I remember calling my statistician friend while we were doing the rule committee and asking him questions and feeling like I didn't really know what I was doing. But I felt so vindicated talking to this guy. And I talked to him afterwards and he was very validating. He was probably being polite, but he was like, yeah, like it sounds like y'all understood the problem. It's a problem he says he sees all the time. And there's actually another like math guy there whose job was like helping, I don't know what it was. He didn't go into detail. Like I assume like businesses make like evaluation systems. And he was talking about a lot of the things that we talked about when we're doing the judging system and our three-way conversation. I was like, okay, like we completely identified the problems, whether or not we solved them, whatever, people can debate that. But the things that we encountered that were difficult are things that anyone who builds a system like this are going to have to confront. And they were very, like, I don't want to oversell it, but I feel like they were impressed by some of the solutions we came up with. For instance, I explained to them the nonlinear diff, and I know that's like not everyone's favorite thing, but they were like, oh, that's a really good way to solve one problem, which is what one of them described as like psychological like friction of it's really easy to give a 5 instead of a 4, but it's really hard to give a 10 instead of a 9. Like he said, that's a problem they have all the time building these evaluation systems because people move a lot between, you know, 3 and 6, but they hardly move at all between 7 and 10. So anyway, like they were kind of fired up about some of the things we did. And not surprisingly, it was a super overeducated audience. So maybe I got lucky that people could sort of follow, but it was really fun. Okay. I just blithered for a long time. Any thoughts, comments, questions?
It sounds really interesting. Was your presentation recorded?
It might be, but I'm sort of loath to find out or spread it around because one, as I said, sometimes you have to be a little fast and loose, especially when you're responding to questions. So like, especially when I was talking about the history of freestyle, a lot of times I'm just sort of like making the narrative that helps me explain my point the best. And I did say a lot, like simplifying, like here's sort of what happened. And also like I have the simple, like I was talking to Will about this. I really don't know what you're supposed to do as a professor, period. But especially in a situation like this, where you're talking to a lay audience, like any of the things I talked about, you could write a book on with lots of detail that actually explains all the nuances of things. But in order to make a presentation that people could understand that was effective, you kind of have to cut corners and simplify things.
I agree.
Like for instance, I mean, here's a really super simple one that's like not a big deal at all. Other things I did were much more truncating, shortening, simplifying. But you know, like I was just like, let's say you get a 1-point deduction for every drop. It's really 0.9, and it's really 0.9 because there's 3 judges giving it a 0.3. But there's no reason to explain that. That's a bunch of unnecessary detail. So it's easier to say 0.9. So, I know. You know,
there wouldn't
whatever.
Be any content if everyone was perfect. So you gotta, like, yeah.
Exactly. Like I told this story from like the Qin Dynasty in 200 BC. That is like one of my favorite stories. And of course, I told it hyper simplified And like, I don't want some Chinese scholar to like contact me and be like, you totally butchered this, you know, the history of these two generals in the Qin dynasty. And I'm like, yeah, I know I did. But my justification for it, because I was like kind of thinking about it on the car back, because it's just like a routine, right? Like everything is just happening in real time. And there's things you're happy that you did. And there's things you're like, oh, why did I do that? Or why did I say that? But I remember in high school, we did a section in our literature class on like Vietnam stories. And there's this movement that, you know, it's funny as I'm saying, like, I'm doing the thing that I'm complaining about right here. But I have said this on the podcast before, that I get nervous when I'm like talking off the cuff about these things that I don't know the details of. But whatever, there was this movement I remember in writing about the Vietnam War, where soldiers were writing completely made up stories about what happened to them. And the idea was that these stories, although completely fictional, better conveyed their experience and like their reality than what actually happened. And I think about that a lot. Like, to me, when I'm teaching people things, I'm not so concerned about making sure I have the facts correct. I'm more concerned about telling the story in a way that conveys the principle most clearly, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, we're all human, so that is probably the way that humans absorb stuff the best.
And I will say, that's how I learn things. Like, I, you know, as a history major, I couldn't tell you anything about history in terms of what happened, when, and who, but I can often tell you, well, here's this idea that was floating around and like kind of how it played out. And it's like very metaphysical. And to me, that's the part that I'm interested in, like the feeling or the theory or the philosophy of it, not the actual events on the ground. And I do say all the time in this presentation on the podcast, like, simplifying a little bit, or I'm not going to get this totally right. But at a certain point, I just have to stop saying that. It's kind of like saying you're sorry all the time. It's just sort of like, just move on. Just talk. But this, I don't know, more therapy. This is my problem as a lawyer, too. Like, people always want me to put my names on things that I write for them. But I'm like, no, I don't want my name on this. I don't want any responsibility for anything I say ever. So as I'm just so nervous about every tiny little thing that might be not perfect about it. But that's my curse that I live with. So anyways, long story short, if there is a recording, I might keep it secret.
Okay. This is where why we work well, is because I'm the exact opposite. So I can force you to do things that normally wouldn't exist, like this podcast.
I made such great strides in terms of this, being on this podcast and shooting from my hip and not worrying too much about what I say. But that's sort of my experience. Like, even as I'm explaining what I said in the presentation, I'm like nervous. Did I even say that? I don't know. But like, that was my intention. Okay. Anyways, now that's all my updates. You have some questions. You described it to me before we got on as, these are listener questions, but you're the listener.
Yep. Well, I listen to all the podcasts after we record them, so it is a listener question.
Fair enough.
Okay. There are two, but I think we only have time for one.
Okay.
Okay. So, what are things you do or have done that other people aren't doing? Or like, what are the, yeah. So like, it can be things like equipment or practice or your mentality. And like, how do you think those things help you? And why don't you think other people do them?
That's a great question. It's probably one I should have thought about more. But I'll say, on the drive home from Ultimate today, Will just said, I can't remember what we were talking about, but Will's just like, yeah, you know, I guess you just have to practice you have to play by yourself more, but no one really does that. And I was just like, yes, like that is the number one thing. Like, Will is becoming one of the best players in the world because he plays by himself a lot. And he doesn't even I don't know, I'm not like there, but it doesn't even mean practice in some super technical way, because I know sometimes people, rightly or wrongly, think I'm just some robot that was, I don't know, like military style drills to get better. But like, literally just playing by yourself, with the emphasis on playing. I know, like, Fabio played, like, jammed with himself all the time. Dave Murphy still jams with himself all the time. Will's playing with himself all the time. That is the number one way to get better at freestyle, because you can play more. You know, it's a small sport. Most people don't live somewhere where they can play anytime they want with somebody else. But just because there's not someone to play with doesn't mean you can't go out there and futz around. But other things that I do, I don't know, now I'll contradict myself a little bit and say, like, I'm always focused on what I can't do. Like, that's the part that interests me the most. Like, I can do lots of things. Like, it's kind of, you made a joke once where you said, like, have you forgotten more moves than they know? And it's kind of like, yes. And the reason for that is a lot of moves, once I have kind of mastered them, I'm on to the next move. Of course, there's lots of moves that stay in the arsenal that are never going to leave. Like, I'm always going to delay. I'm always going to chess roll. But in theory, like, the kinds of moves that I'm focusing on are very different from, you know, pick your time frame, if not month to month, at least year to year. And to me, that's the only thing that keeps it interesting. And of course, I've talked a little bit about how I'm sort of starting to feel like I'm running out of things that I really want to learn that I didn't already learn. But I don't think a lot of people do that. You know, most people play to their strengths, right? What do you think you did? Like, what was your strategy?
Like, the things I was doing that no one else, my first thing was the solo practice. Like, practiced 45 minutes every day after work during the week. And I don't think anyone else in my, like, definitely no one else in Seattle was doing that. And
yeah,
it was obvious that I was getting better and everyone else was the same every weekend when I would go out and play with everyone.
One thing kind of on the work on your weakness front. So Andre, one of our best, most devoted listeners, shout out to Andre. He sent me this video from a climbing instructor and I really appreciated him sending it. I really enjoyed watching it. I'll say I watched whatever it was, like 25 minutes. I'm not even sure what he was saying 95% of the time. And I think he had like 4 points that he made in ways that were so bewildering and wordy and confusing that probably could have been done much more easily. But in fairness, some of it was more climbing focused, so I couldn't necessarily follow the examples. But one of the things I understood him to be talking about, which I haven't necessarily exemplified well in my life, but it's something I do try to do sometimes, and I think most people don't try to do it. But it's basically to create kind of like arbitrary barriers or challenges to accelerate your learning. So like, let's say you're trying to do a chess roll. I think this is like the one time I think my like chess roll tutorial I did was a lot about this. So you could sit there practicing the ideal chess roll over and over and over again to get better at that. And that's probably what you should do a lot of the time, or maybe even most of the time. But you should also practice the unideal chess roll, or a lot of different ways, entry points, exit points to the chess roll. And you can, I'm sure there's a lot of different psychological brain function reasons that that helps you learn faster. But I think one simple way to understand it is like every learning method has diminishing returns. So if you try 25 ways to learn the same chess roll, you get that maximum return on all 25 ways rather than doing the one way over and over again to the point where you reach the, I'm not getting much more out
of this.
That's
cool. I've never heard of it that way. Like the diminishing
returns. I have no idea.
That makes so much sense.
It makes sense, right?
Yeah, thank you. I do that, but I never thought about it that way.
That's not what that guy says. I have no brain science to support that. I mean, he says the like try different ways of learning. That's my explanation for why it works. So don't quote me on that in the history psychologists who study these kinds of things. But like, I'll give you my current example, which is kind of a terrible example because I'm still very bad at it. But I've been working on the leg roll forever. And for a long time, I had a stack of whiz rings and I just would toss up one whiz ring, do the leg roll, let that whiz ring sit on the ground and do another one. Boom, 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 over and over and over again. And you could kind of describe the variables of that. It was a whiz ring, not a disc. It was a like simple set, a self set. And it was all in a row with no reset in between because it was just like boom, 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 boom. Once I got good at that, then I switched to a desk. So now I've changed to, and like I also say ideally, and this is true for me, like you would be mixing through all these at the same time. It's not like you would do one, then switch to the next one. Like every day, maybe you do a different one, but like just for the sake of simplicity, we'll do it this way. Then I do it with a disc. So now instead of a whiz ring, I have a disc and those have different shapes, different functions. I would even go as far as saying like use different disc, use different color disc, use different shape disc, like all those make a difference. Then I switch to different sets. So I'll start with a flat delay, put a rim precession to get that into the angle, and then do the roll off of that. So now I have a different setup. I'm going to have a lot more spin on the disc. I'm probably going to have a different angle on the disc. I have to figure out how to make the leg roll work this way. Then I'll do kind of the same thing I would do with a whiz ring or a disc where I'm self-setting, but I'm only going to have one disc or one whiz ring. And so I have to practice doing the move, getting out of position, walking over, grabbing the disc and doing it again. And in a different part of the room, like every little thing matters. Like I remember when I was learning, studying techniques, whenever, when I was in high school, like every variable helps solidify your learning. Like if you always study in the library, you should take some days and study in your room, study at the park, study at the coffee shop, because you don't want your brain to be relying on that environment to do the thing. And I think we've all experienced that where you're like, you know, I'm really good at this move in my bedroom where I practice it, but whenever I try to do it in the gym, I can't do it. But like every variable just kind of like strengthens the connections. And I think that's a very powerful way to play. And I have heard that, and I think I talked about this once before, like the big thing in basketball practice now is instead of doing super repetitive drills, you do drills that break up your moves, because one of the hardest things of doing anything is repriming it of sort of like, because like, I think we also have the experience of my first five leg rolls I miss, but my next 15 I hit. So the thing I need to learn is hitting my first one. And so if I want to practice hitting the first one, it's not like, well, I can only do that once a day. Like every day I get one shot. It's like, no, I'll do the first one. Then I'll do five other things to get my brain to move on. And then I'll go back and get that first try again. So I think that's a good technique. Like, I don't think I've done that nearly enough. I think a lot of people kind of do it naturally because you'll get tired and bored doing the same move over and over again. So I think a lot of times when I practice, like, I'll do this for a while and then I'll come back to it in 5 or 10 minutes. And I think that's effective. But those are like practice techniques. I'm trying to think if there's anything I do differently from like equipment or other things. I think the headband is real. Like, people sort of tease me about it, especially at Ultimate. But when I try to play without a headband, I'm just like, you people are crazy. Maybe I'm just sweatier than other people or something, but it's a huge impact to have the sweat in my face. And because, and I see people do this all the time, because I have to brush it away every now and then, now I have the sweat on my hands, and that's a problem. I need my hands. My hands need to be in perfect conditions with perfect humidity levels.
You tell me this every time we play, and I think the downsides of the headband for me are way more than the positives.
What are the downsides of wearing a headband?
The biggest one for me is it makes me dizzy. Like, for some reason, when it's like squeezing my head, my balance, like I can't double chair with a headband on, I'll fall over.
Whatever like a negative placebo is, this is what that is. It's like, what? Like that? What are you talking about? That's crazy. That's like psychosomatic.
It might be, but it's very instant. Like I can reproduce it every time.
We might have to get you a different headband or something. I don't know.
But I do use a headband on the exercise bike because it makes a huge difference on having sweat like burn my eyes for 90 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, equipment in general probably is underappreciated in terms of importance. I don't know if I've told this story before, but John Wooden, the very famous UCLA basketball coach, who's like one of the winningest basketball coaches ever, and has like a very interesting story because they were terrible for like 15 years and then they won like 10 years in a row or something really crazy. It was like one of the most impressive sports turnarounds in history. And they went from a program where they didn't even have their own basketball court and they were sharing it with like ballet or something, and then became the biggest, most dominant basketball program in the country. But anyways, he had lots of interesting things he did, and he wrote a lot of books that are kind of like how to get good at something. I read a lot of them when I was young and I was obsessed with drumming. I don't really remember a lot of the details, and I'm not sure what I would think about them now if I would appreciate them. But one of the only things I remember from those books is whenever players joined his team, he would bring them in and he would check their shoes. And he said most players, their shoes were too big because when you're young, your parents are always buying you a couple shoe sizes too big. So you'll grow into them. But at a certain point, you obviously don't. But most people don't go backwards. Sort of like at some point they bought a shoe that was too big, they didn't grow into it, and they never went back a size. And so he made sure everyone had proper fitting shoes, and then he taught them all how to tie their shoes a certain way that was the most effective way. And I kind of think it's crazy sometimes when people are so loosey-goosey. Like, I look at their nail kit and all their nails are completely different shapes and sizes and condo levels. Where Daniel, who, like, I guess ironically is probably one of the best, if not the best kicker ever, he has like a different pair of shoes on every time I see him. Sometimes he's wearing two different shoes on the same moment, and it doesn't seem to affect him. But I think for most people, you know, you should find the best shoe for you. You should make sure it fits. You should tie it well, and you should let that consistency help you as a player. Now, maybe you're practicing in different shoes, going back to my prior point, just trying to cheat code your way into more variability. But I think when you want to perform at the highest level, consistency is generally really important. And there's lots of research, for instance, on like routines and how useful those are. But I think part of your routine can be, I wear the same shoes, I put them on in the same way. I mean, I basically wear the same outfit all the time. It's probably ridiculous and I look foolish, but that comfort of knowing this is exactly what I'm always doing, I think helps me as a player.
Do you think there's something you do that no one else does?
I don't know. Can you think of anything?
Is there another player that uses Vaseline?
I think a lot of people have adopted Vaseline from me. Like, I know Will's using it. I think Benno uses it. I mean, the way I know this is, you know, the first 2 years when I go to Europe, if I didn't have Vaseline, I was out of luck. No one else was going to have Vaseline. Now, when I go to the Berlin Hat Tournament, and I'm like, does anyone have Vaseline? Everyone's like, over here, over here, over here. And I want credit for that. I don't know if I'm going to get it. It's kind of an embarrassing thing to be credit for that. But I brought Vaseline to the masses. I am the big Vaseline believer. I think sleep is one of my big things. I know other people care about it too. But I think that was a big factor in my success. I guess I'm hypothesizing. I don't know that. But it seems to be reasonable. A lot of people don't care about their sleep, but it's probably the most important thing you can do to solidify.
I know. I've been spreading the sleep crusade to like bike friends. I'm like, this is the most important part of recovery.
And Will's an extreme sleeper also. And I think that's part of why he's getting so good. So I don't know. I think my video making obsession is also pretty unique. And I've talked a lot about before of how important I think that is to my success. But like, I should say for all of this, and I'm sure I brought this up before, but there's always survivorship bias of like, obviously I turned out to be good at freestyle. So now I can just look back at all the random things I did that probably were meaningless and be like, that's why I turned out really well. And it may be, you know, that's just nonsense and it could have been other ways and it would have been the same. But I think most of the things I'm talking about here are things that in other fields where it's been studied or considered, it seems to be important. And some of these things I do because I read about those things and was like, oh, I should implement them. And some of those things I think I was just lucky enough to stumble into. Like, I think ironically, I've had a lot of trouble as a sleeper my whole life. And so I've known from an early age how important sleep was because it was like a constant battle for me to deal with insomnia. So like, because it was a problem, it became a priority and it's sort of like turning a weakness into a strength, I guess.
Is that the Morgan Freeman thing where he had a speech impediment when he was younger, so they got a speech coach and now that's why he has such a silky voice?
That's true. That's a great story. I mean, it's like, I still have a lot of trouble sleeping. I don't want to oversell it. I wish I could say I've conquered my sleep demons. There are times where I think I have, but I like the last few months I've been really struggling with my sleep again and I can't really explain it. But I think me struggling with my sleep is still far better than most people who like don't even try to sleep or think about sleep. But like, for instance, I think like if I go to the gym and I jam all day, I'm like, oh man, I better get a good night's sleep because not only do I want to be rested for tomorrow, I want to let my brain solidify all that information it just processed today. And as we've talked about before, I'm sure every freestyle has experienced, when you're going to bed after sleep or freestyling all day, like not only is your brain just like filled with freestyle and it's like having a song stuck in your head, but it's freestyle. You have those like twitches where you're doing moves as you're falling asleep. So your brain is trying to work something out. after you freestyle, and the way it does that is through sleep. So you got to give it a chance to do it. Otherwise, I think that's all I got on what I do that's unique. Can you think of anything else that maybe I do?
Do you think there is a negative thing you do that no one else does?
I eat terribly, okay. Which I've talked about. That was
the obvious one. Yeah.
I mean, I eat so badly, and I just feel like every day I'm like, I'm going to change and do better, and I just can't do it. And I think when I hear about people who have like drug addictions or who like struggle with their weight, not to say that my problems are anything like that. I don't mean to say equivalency at all, but I can understand that feeling of not having control over what you do, because I know that I eat badly, and every single day I'm like, tomorrow I'm just not going to do that. Tomorrow I'm going to eat a banana and have a smoothie and eat some chicken. And then every day I wake up and I'm just like, I'm going to eat this giant bag of cookies and cream Hershey's. And that's what I did. But I'm sure I've done lots of things bad. I think I was a really bad thrower for a long time, which we've talked about. And I think that gave me some strengths. Like, I think I'm really good with very little spin, but I'm sure I missed out on some learning efficiency because I wasn't giving myself very good spin. I think there's lots of things that you can learn more quickly when you have good spin amounts. I think I've stumbled on a relatively good strategy for my body because my body's held up pretty well. Although my back has been a problem recently. So maybe I'm wrong and my bills are about to come due. So we'll see. Anything you think I've done wrong?
I can't think of anything that hasn't been corrected.
What are some things that you think I corrected?
This is the biggest. Okay. So if you were to ask me this question, I would say playing the game. So the abuse routine. So that's something you didn't do before, but now that was your whole talk in your little presentation was about that. Like, if you went back 6 years ago, you would think exactly the opposite of everything you just said.
Well, I don't know. My presentation wasn't so much about, like, when I talked about how rules change behavior, it wasn't necessarily meant about like you should abuse them, but I'd say I found peace with finding a way to play that I thought did what I wanted to do, but also within the rules. It's like the little things. Like, my favorite example being, I want to do a bunch of hard stuff in my routine, but under the old system I should at least spread it out because it's more valuable in the time block system. Like, that's a really easy thing to do that doesn't really compromise my freestyle values. And then I think I also just learned that trying to do something that just is a low probability of success just like isn't worth it under any standard. It's just sort of like the expected value of this is just too low, even if it was a theater performance. You know what I mean? It's like, I made that point before, but I think it's weird when people are like, well, you're just doing that so that you'll get more points in a routine. I was like, well, I would 100% do it if it was a performance, because it would be way more damning for me to make that mistake if there was like a crowd of people here to watch it as art. So I don't know, but that's the kind of thing that I don't really value as much as you. So like, whether I did it right or wrong, I'm not like that worried about the consequences of it. Like, I don't need more world titles, so I'm not like too bummed that I missed any other opportunities there. Like, any like non-competition, like, what are things that are like, I'm a worse freestyler because I didn't do X?
I wonder if there's an argument for, could you be, how much better would you be at clock if you didn't play counter?
Yeah, I mean, Will and I were talking about that because I think I mentioned before that we're doing the summer of counter. We're only playing counter, and we're pretty, I'm not even say pretty, we're diehard about it. I mean, we do not throw clock. We do not throw anything that looks like clock. If you get it upside down counter and you turn it over, you immediately try to spin change it back to counter. But like, when we were kind of starting it, I was sort of like, you know, I would say this is a valuable thing for you to do, Will. But like, Ryan certainly wouldn't think that. And you should think for yourself of whether you want to devote this much energy to counter. And probably because he was raised in my school, he's like, I want to do counter. And I was like, that's fine. Like, and I'm happy about that because I would like to work on my counter because as I said, I feel like it's fallen off with how much we play clock at Duke. And I'll say happily that I think both of our counter games have gotten way, way better, even in, you know, the month or 6 weeks we've been doing it. But yeah, I mean, it's an argument. Like, I think sometimes I think I had a slower start. Like, I don't know, like maybe this is where you should come in with your perspective. Like, if you think about all the like young players who became top players, I was probably like relatively late to reach that status. Like, Daniel was way better than me for however many years it was. And part of me wonders if some of that was because I was dividing my skills between two spends. I don't know. It's just like a thought. And I definitely thought in my head while I was doing it, like, one day this will all pay off. Does it pay off one-to-one? Probably not. But like, I just thought it was worth it and it was something I cared about.
The thing is, you're comparing yourself to Daniel, which is...
Yeah, like, of course. It's like
you need to compare yourself against the average of all free stars, which is impossible to know. And
maybe, but I mean, I don't know how much we talked about this before, but when I did like a few years ago, I asked people to send me their first videos of themselves, and I was just shocked at how good everyone was. Like, I'm certain I've said before that everyone just forgets how good people are. Like, even though I'm like truly obsessed with how good Will is right now, like, sometimes I worry that I'm too caught up in it as well. And I'm like, well, like, maybe Etta was that good at this time. Maybe like other people were this good at this time too. And we just like forget so quickly. Like, the example I remember specifically is I saw a video of Florian Hess after like 1 year. And I was like, that's like 90% Flo is there. Like, Daniel's the same way. If you can find the 2010 routine we did, he's been playing 8 or 9 months and his form is incredible. And a shocking amount of his game is there. He does a move in that routine that I still think I couldn't do. It's like a series of behind the head, upside down pulls that are so clean.
I think that's a different problem though. Like, I don't think that's like that's how freestyle works. I think that's like when we figure out freestyle, we'll look back and be like, oh, we were doing it wrong the whole time. And that was a symptom.
Yeah, I mean, I will say the Wills and the Duke students of the world make me think we could make people really good at freestyle in a couple of years. And as crazy and blasphemous as that is to say, that's kind of how it works in a lot of other sports. Like, a lot of the best basketball players in the world, I mean, you think about it, like, most top athletes are like 18 years old. A lot of them really only played like a few years because they're only 18 years old. And it might not have been obvious that they were going to be superstars when they were young. So they didn't play that much when they're young. There's also weird evidence that starting really young and doing one thing is not the best thing to do. It's like actually better to be well-rounded and then specialize very late. So maybe we're closer to other things than we realize, and people can learn freestyle quickly. At least it might be one of those things, like, people can learn freestyle very quickly in the right conditions. I still think like the throw and the delay are big hindrances because you can't start practicing on your own that effectively. But if there was a million freestylers in the world and you showed up to freestyle camp and you had someone throwing you 900 spin over and over and over again, maybe people would learn very quickly. And I think also, of course, like, freestyle is still very self-guided, and that still is generally how I do things here. And we've talked about how I think it's important to let people do what they want to do. We care more about people continuing freestyle than learning freestyle. However, like, because you're playing with me and because I will give you some guidance, you're probably learning it in a much more structured and logical order than like some random person learning by themselves would do. And that probably speeds you up a lot. And I think if you were coming to me and you were like, I don't know how to freestyle, but I'm obsessed with freestyle and I want to devote my life to this, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, then I think I could go crazy and I could make you absolutely incredible at freestyle. And it would just be a discipline. It'd be like, I know you want to work on that, but we're actually going to work on this thing. And here's how we're going to do it. And it's like, this would be more like military drill style. And there would be other stuff too, of course, but like, there could be a regimented way to do it.
This is a complete segue, but in ballet, you have to take ballet for like 5 years before you can go to point. And like, it's just never allowed before that, like, threshold.
Well, that's a great example. Yeah. I mean, the couple ballet classes I did, it's like you show up and they put you on a bar and you basically like stretch for an hour. And I'm like, what is this? when do I get to do any of the fun stuff? But obviously they figured out that that's the fastest way to get people to where they want to go. So, but again, I mean, we talked about it before. For us, we have to balance keeping people interested versus maximizing their skill. And not everyone's goal is to maximize their skill. So, but yeah, I mean, I think about it. Like, I think now that, you know, I hate to say it, I know that people much older than me keep playing and keep growing. I know that I'm certainly at the diminishing return part of the curve, right? So like, how much better am I really going to get at freestyle over the rest of my life? I would love it if I get twice as good. Is that realistic?
Yeah.
Probably not.
I don't think it would be that hard even for you to be twice as good.
If I have the bandwidth and am not consumed by parenthood and life, we can try to make me twice as good when you go here. I would love that. Assuming I even have the motivation anymore. But like, I have to, well, I think this is true for things outside of freestyle. I wonder if you feel the same. Like, and again, I get that it sounds ridiculous for like a 32-year-old to be like, well, as I reflect on my life. But like, I am reflecting on my life more. And it's not like when I was 20 and I'm like, everything's in the future and you can have no regrets because you haven't really decided anything yet. Now I have to look back on my life so far and be like, is there anything I wish I'd done differently? Or like, how might my life be better or worse depending on certain choices that I made? And when I look back at my freestyle life and I'm like, realistically, with the resources I had and the mentors I had and the people I had, how much more juice could I have sucked out of this thing? Like, how much better could I be right now? And I'd say, like, I think I got most of what could be expected. I think I lost a lot the first few years because I wasn't as dedicated, in part because I'd come off of drumming where I burned out and I was really nervous about burning out. And so like, I didn't practice that much at the beginning, but like, other than that, I think I went to pretty much every single tournament I could possibly go to. I jammed basically every single opportunity I had, and I practiced probably as much as I could stand. Mm-hmm. Like,
I think that was a lot. Like, did,
like, it isn't a crazy amount, but like, I practiced a lot.
It would be like in your post-game, post-life stats, it would be like, how well did you make use of all your resources? Like, what was your efficiency? I think it would be very high, but that doesn't mean you're the best freestyler possible. Like, I think the best freestyler possible is like still 10 times as what you achieved. But like, what you achieved with your resources is like 97% of what you could have been.
See, that's very generous, but like, that's the way to think about it, right? And like, I've definitely thought about it in that terms of like, if you died and got your game stats, like, what would it say? And like, my guess, it would be more like 80 to 90, but like, that's a lot. I don't think many people get like 80 to 90. And again, like, you have to balance here your motivation too. Like, you have to like factor in who you are. Like, someone could take my body and even my brain, but if you injected them with someone else's motivation, they could probably be 10 times better. Like, I don't have like that many like physical or like other limitations that are preventing me from doing it. But like, you, I'm like taking the personality I got, but it's kind of like, you can get really philosophical here and be like, no, like, I've 100% realized my resources, because if I had any more resources, I would have done better or something. But like, I don't know, like, just in my heart of hearts, I feel like I did about like 90% of like what I could have reasonably expected to do. And like, I'm pretty pleased with that. Like, in contrast, like, when I think about my career and work, I think I'm operating more like at like 60%. Like, I think I could have done, like, there's a few choices where I'm like, oh, I wish I'd done that, and I would be in like a better place financially in particular. But like, I don't really, like, things have obviously worked out pretty well for me, so I'm not worried about that. And again, like, I think like even shooting 50% is really good. Like, sometimes, like, I've been watching a lot of movies lately and also like reading about Buddhism, and you just like realize that like most people are just like so disappointed in their life. And I can like sympathize with that, because there are definitely disappointments in my life. But I mean specifically like disappointments with decisions you made. Like, obviously there's lots of disappointments of things that have happened that are outside of my control in my life. But in terms of like, what could I have done differently? Where did I go wrong? I don't have a lot of things like that. And that's really nice. But I think most people are pretty lucky if they look back and they're like 50% happy with what they chose to do, right?
I think so. Actually,
I don't want to sound like naive or like mean or wrong, but I think, like I've said before, I think I got really lucky. Like, I think if I lived my life 100 more times, not that many more work out this well in terms of my like well-being. And my well-being has lots of problems, don't get me wrong. But like, given what I'm capable of experiencing, and I think I did okay.
I guess there's like two metrics. There's like your privilege, which is all your choices, and then like, did you pick the best choice at every moment? So like chess does this really well, where it calculates your accuracy at the end of the game, and it's like, how close to the best move did you pick at each move? And they use that for like certain things, but it's like really interesting to like look at. And I'm like, I think about that in my life all the time. Like, I mean, I probably made a bad choice that put me in a worse position now, but I can still make the best decision with the choices I have remaining.
Yeah. Like, I think for me, I think where I lost efficiency was, again, the beginning, I wasn't as committed.
But how did you know that if you were fully committed at the start, you could have burned out much earlier?
That's fair.
So maybe you did make the right decision.
Like, I think it's like, I could have done, let's say, twice as much practice, which sounds like a lot, but I wasn't practicing very much and not burned out. But I agree that if I went full throttle, I probably would have burned out. And like, for instance, it might have been devastating to lose at some point if I had like put my whole life into it and then like it wasn't happening and maybe got jaded like other people. That doesn't really sound like me, but I guess it's possible. But it's more like I would have just been like, I can't keep practicing this. I'm so sick of it. Like, what happened with drumming? But like, that felt like a low point or like a missed opportunity. The other one, which is the more interesting one, is in a lot of ways, I feel like, and some of this is the pandemic, which is outside of my control, but like before 2019, I was full throttle, like freestyling, practicing, getting better. I was in will mode, like totally insane and rapidly improving. And then like a bunch of things happened in my life that kind of like derailed me. And then the pandemic happened, and then I moved to Durham. And I think like I lost a ton of efficiency for some period of time, like a couple years. But there was a lot more for me to be gained at that time to keep playing in New York every day and having people to jam with and playing with Dougie, et cetera. However, now that I'm in year 4 or 5 here, I think I'm like gaining efficiency. Like there's a lot more that I'm getting out of playing with Will than I would have gotten out of playing with jamming. So like that's like good place. It's like hard to know how like some things that were negative turn into positives. But the thing that I will never know that will probably haunt me is like if 2019 pandemic moving hadn't happened the way it had happened, how much longer would I have maintained Will mode? Because like in my heart, I feel like I would have gone forever, and maybe realistically I would have kept it up for 5 years or 10 years. But now I feel like I haven't been in that mode since then. Like I still play a lot, mostly because Will makes me play a lot, but I don't practice like I used to, and I don't have the motivation like I used to. And is it natural aging? Like, would it have happened anyways? Or did it get wildly accelerated by life, COVID, and moving?
Mm-hmm. We'll never know.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Is it, I don't think we've ever talked about it. Do you, cause like, it's honestly until the lot, like recently, it was like hard to, for me to even think about, cause it's like so upsetting that
I lost
this like period of my life of freestyle. But like, do you think I would have lost my motivation eventually anyways?
I think you would have lost your motivation eventually. I think I've told you this before, but like your happiness efficiency is high. Like it's, your current path is so much higher in happiness than that other path you just described, staying in New York.
Yeah. I mean, I also think like if you step back to like life efficiency, which is kind of what you're doing there, like I gained a lot in like life efficiency, even if I lost some in freestyle efficiency. And like that's the thing I'm balancing now, which I know I've kind of talked about before. It's just sort of like, I still have a foot in freestyle, but I don't have both feet in. And part of it is because like, maybe I don't want to devote will mode for another 10 years and then be like, okay, freestyle's dead. What did I do with my life? But like, I don't think that's really what's going to happen. I think freestyle will continue long, long and forever, especially if we keep working at it. But, you know, balance, I struggle with balance, but as I've said before, like I'm sort of inadvertently getting there, and maybe this is the optimal outcome. It's almost like when you have to stick with your investment strategy, even though emotionally it's difficult. It's like if I were advising someone like me, I'd be like, no, 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 you're fine. You're practicing enough. You're playing enough. You will keep freestyling and getting better, but you're also living a normal, healthy life. like stick with that. That's fine.
I feel like I'm that person, right? You recently texted me. It's like, is there any reason for me to practice anymore?
Yeah, but you gave me the worst advice. You were like, well, like maybe if there's some change in the competitive landscape or the Olympics. I'm like, no, I don't care about competition. I just want to know like who I'm practicing for. but whatever. Okay. We've gone like an hour. I know you have another question, but maybe we should save it for our next podcast. Also, sorry we're late again. You know, life is very busy. What can I say?
It was jammers.
What's your moving here looking like?
And
what's your timeline?
It's the same. August 2025. The summer in Seattle is so much better than anywhere else. So it's too valuable to give up when I'm already here.
Okay, well, thank you all for listening. I would love some feedback on an episode like this because I do feel like, again, we get into sort of like personal therapy, and I just wonder if it's interesting to people or boring to people, or if like people can relate to it or not. Do you have any thought on that before we go?
I think people like it. They just, I mean, human nature is to like whatever is it, find other humans. So like we're giving content for people to like relate to.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if there's one listener, I guess we did something worthwhile, and that's the story I'm going to tell myself. Okay, cool. Thank you all for listening. Check us out at clockerconnor.com. I'm pretty sure that website's still up because I think I just got a charge on my credit card for its renewal. And we'll see you next month. We'll try to record at the end of this month, so you'll get to in June. And anything besides Worlds coming up? I'm sure there's a bunch of European tournaments that we don't really follow.
I think German Championships is in a couple of weeks.
German Championships. Go to that. That'll be awesome. That's the Munich guys putting that on. I'm sure it's going to be awesome. Post some videos on YouTube, people out there. I know you like to post on Instagram or Facebook, but if you want me to watch them, put them on YouTube. We need some more,
James is
some
old
more content
now.
Out there. Yeah. I'm putting up... I've got like literally 25 videos I should just unlist, and they'll all have 3 views, but that's fine. Like I have content. If you're starred for freestyle content, I've got jams on jams. There's like a sick video of me, Jake, Lori, and Will, and it's like nobody's watched it. And I'm like, that's a great group of freestylers. And I did put some really avant-garde music on it, so it's probably really boring. But, you know, we just need more content. We need more people consuming it. Also, maybe, sorry, I'm blithering. Maybe we should restart the email chain. I know there's an FPA newsletter, but that's like a one-way communication platform. Like, what if we just started the next Jammers on the Net?
Wait, how does this, what, how is this better than the current Jammers on the Net?
Jammers on the Net's gone.
What? No, I email it every time we post a podcast. I know people get it because they tell me they get, that's the only time they get the email.
Really? Yeah. Jammer? Oh, maybe someone made it again on Google?
Yeah.
I guess the problem is like we don't have control over it. So I don't know how to add people to it or get people involved. So I might create my own. I'm going to just think about it because it's low barrier. Like all I need is your email and then I can reach you and you can reach me. And it's not like I need people to adopt a new platform or.
What is the purpose of this forum?
Just a universal way to communicate with people that we are lacking right now.
Oh, I see. It's just like one more social media platform.
Yeah, except that everyone already has it and it's passive. Like I don't need people to log into it to get information.
I see.
I don't know. Maybe it's a terrible idea, but I'm thinking about it. If you think it's a good idea or a terrible email, terrible idea, email us at clockercountergeneral.com. All right, that's it. We're done. See you next time. Thank you.